You're supposed to say, and the Oscar goes to.
And the winner is.
Chicago!
And now, ladies and gentlemen, coming to you live from the Onyx Club, a podcast unlike any other podcast. I give up. Tay Diggs, he does it way better. Welcome back. This is, and the award goes to, a podcast that rolls through every Best Picture winner from this century, just like Roxy Hart rolling through musical numbers. I'm Luke Shoemaker, and with me, as always, is the other side of this duo, Zach King. Last time, we got a glimpse into a beautiful mind. This time, we strike up the band for the 75th Academy Award winner for Best Picture, Chicago. Zach, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate yourself as a singer? And should I serenade our listeners with some of our classics from college?
Well, Luke, like you, I'd say we both come in at about a 2 on the singing scale. Yeah, well, just being real. And, you know, I'm afraid if we were to let you sing on this pod, our listeners would quit on us, much like Amos finally quit Roxy.
Now I'm questioning our entire friendship that I thought was built upon our musical numbers. Chicago, let's open with reflections. You want me to go, or you want to lead us off?
You go ahead.
All right, so I watched this on cable TV around 5 years ago, and I had just moved out of our college house, or around then. It might have been 7 years ago. And I think I just had it on more of like background noise type of thing. I think I was grading papers, and sometimes it's good just to have something on. And I do remember looking up time to time some of the music I enjoy and some of the choreography I thought was neat. And then on rewatch, I felt about the same. I kept checking the progress meter for my Chromecasting to see how much was left. And I usually only check time when I'm like doing a T25 workout with my wife. And it's like, how much is left? I want to get to the end. But, you know, and I was checking on this often. And I think my biggest takeaway from it is, you know, Hollywood was having this like musical reawakening that we kind of touched on last time with Moulin Rouge. And it just so happened that the Academy were caught up in that reawakening. And, you know, musicals, they're like comedies. They're hard to stack up when you're talking Best Picture. I mean, that can be entertaining, but it's really hard for them to be just groundbreaking film. And that's what has always been hard for me with musicals. For this, I struggled to get invested into the story, and you'll talk about it in our issues section later, but movies like La La Land introduced the music into the plot like seamlessly. Mamma Mia, The Greatest Showman, even Sweeney Todd, you know, the music provided the plot, or to the plot, and it didn't like distract you too much. The switching back and forth from reality to the burlesque, it's just not great film storytelling, in my opinion. And that was one of my biggest takeaways from rewatch.
Okay, man, kind of similar to you. So for our listeners, I did not watch Chicago back when I was 13. And this is nothing against musicals. Once again, for our listeners, I'll say this. I love musicals. Love them. Adore them. Grew up watching Seven Brides for Seven Brothers for our true musical lovers. Classic West Side Story as well. So not against musicals. I watched Chicago, you know, for recently for the first time for this pod. And my God, how did this one get nominated, two win Best Picture, and three, how is it even considered a good musical? I'm sorry. It is not good. It did not hold up in any way for me. And my biggest complaint is, you kind of touched on it, the fact that as a musical, okay, you're filming your regular dialogue scenes like you'd see any movie that cut into the music bit. Well, in fucking Chicago, they leave the scene and go to the burlesque theater and do the music bit, and it completely distracts from the story and the plot and what's going on. And it's constant. So for a musical, I'd never seen that. And you mentioned one I really loved in Sweeney Todd. My God, that's a difficult story too, essentially about murder. But dear Lord, they execute it so much better than this. And I'm sorry. You know, I watched it open-minded. I really did, as someone who does love musicals. I have a soft spot for them, and it very few things about this movie I enjoyed, and we'll get into that.
Tell me how you really feel, right?
Right. I'm sorry.
Attention to details, where we discuss directors, cast, cinematographers, some of the box office numbers, along with the nominations, wins, and its overall historical perspective. So 13 nominations for this film, only eighth ever with that many. Gangs of New York gets 10 the same year. We have that 6-1. Tell us why it's interesting, the combination of the six in regards to being a Best Picture winner.
Well, I mean, and just to reemphasize, 13 nominations, only eight films in Academy history have won that many for a film like Chicago. Okay, whatever. It won six, right? So it only won Best Picture. It won Best Supporting for Catherine Zeta-Jones. So it only won one of the big five category at the Academy. So not so good. The rest were for art direction, sound, costume, editing. So one of the big five. It was only nominated for three out of the big five, though. So, you know, only eligible for three of those anyway. And the first musical to win Best Picture since 1968, Oliver Twist, for those of you who are a fan of that, which I love Oliver Twist. Yeah, fantastic
storyline.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. So, yeah. Do you want me to get into the release date and whatnot? Or?
Yeah, go ahead. And, you know, we talked last time about when the best really time to release a movie so you can garner this accolade. When did this film come out?
Yeah, and how that's evolving. So this one was your, like I was saying, kind of the traditional December release. December 10th limited went wide on the 27th, making the cut. So, you know, fresh in the voters' minds, I guess that played into it, you know. But like we've said on previous pods, this is shifting. More films are releasing in that October-November window and winning. So that's good to see as well. You know, if I was releasing a movie, I don't know if I'd have a true preference on that. But it's just interesting that this film, released late, garnered that many nominations and, you know, pulled off the wins that it did.
Yeah, we talk about that. It's that balance. Do you want to make the most money and do summer?
Mm-hmm.
First, do you want to try to rack up an award season? So it ultimately comes down to, and sometimes, you know, movies blend with the two. But this one, we'll get into the numbers on box office, but it definitely got the accolades.
And it's like Moulin Rouge nominated for Best Picture. To me, that's such a better musical than this. It's like tremendously better. Like if you're going to give the first musical Best Picture winner since 1968, why not Moulin Rouge over this? But that's, you know, neither here nor there.
Tough year for Moulin Rouge, though, I guess.
It was.
We talked about last pod, speaking of Moulin Rouge, about how it like started and ushered in this musical film genre for the 21st century. And, you know, Moulin Rouge, then this, and we'll stack up. There'll be several more within the next 10, 15 years. I thought it was a great sign that the best song for this year did not come from this movie, but it came from 8 Mile, which absolutely deserved it. That song was played by every like 13 to 30 year old in America. And it didn't matter about race or preference. You were, for some reason, it got you jacked, and it's still played in sports arenas today.
And a great movie that still holds up with a very underrated performance from Eminem, who I would not have thought is a good actor, but man, he killed that.
Yeah. I think it has to do with a lot of that is like his life.
Yeah, right.
But it was great. And we go to box office numbers, $170 million domestically. That's 12th for this year. Number one and two, not a shocker, though, because we get Lord of the Rings and we get Harry Potter in the same year. But it finishes 12th domestically, but only $306 million worldwide.
I still think it made a lot of money, honestly. That's, to me, that's pretty darn good.
For 2000, around this time period, yeah, when you adjust for stuff, that's a good haul, you know? That's
or
definitely
a musical.
A good haul. I think they would have liked internationally to be able to have a larger chunk, but when you're dealing with a musical that's entirely in English, I would imagine it's harder to sell that internationally.
Absolutely.
So, we have our director, Rob Marshall. He has a Sam Mendes effect, right?
He does. So this is his first feature film, and he wins Best Picture. Did not win Best Director like Sam Mendes, but still pretty impressive for the, you know, first hit out of the ballpark.
Right. Most of his career has been in musicals. And before this, he mostly did choreography on stage. He has 6 Tony Award nominations. So shows his strength in that area. And some of that choreography kind of comes into play in the scenes in this film. I'll say this, though, if anyone who can get Daniel Day-Lewis to work on a film with them, they've at least done something to build up some sort of credibility, because that guy is very particular on roles that he takes.
Oh, no doubt. And if you're a director that has cast Daniel Day-Lewis in your career, I automatically have a reverence for you. That's saying something. So yeah, and Daniel Day-Lewis was known to do one movie every 4 to 6 years, sometimes longer, and he's officially retired. So,
which
pretty impressive to get.
I hope he does like a Jordan-esque comeback.
Yeah, we can hope. Shout out to Daniel Day-Lewis.
Writer of this film is Bill Condon. 2 nominations with 1 win for Gods and Monsters, which was a best adapted screenplay. Early in his career, the first film he directed, he also wrote with the Coen brothers. And I can only think of a few names in Hollywood who could have a bigger impact on a person. His only other screenplay credit outside of Gods and Monsters was a made-for-TV. So after this movie, he does other musical projects like Dreamgirls and The Greatest Showman, which both for me are pretty fun watches, and I may enjoy those more than I enjoy this film.
Dreamgirls actually is pretty good. I've never seen The Greatest Showman, but I've heard you talk about it a lot, so I need to check that out. And yeah, from what I can tell, he's a pretty impressive writer, especially working with the Coen brothers, and he got an Oscar for a movie I have not seen. Have you seen Gods and Monsters?
I watched it. It was a long time. I just remember Ian McClellan's really good in it. Outside of that, I can't remember much about the movie. It's something after doing this that I want to get back into and watch. I love Ian McClellan.
Well, he's good in everything. Magneto.
He's a good man. Cinematographer. Tell us a little bit about our guy here.
So Dion Beebe, fantastic cinematographer. He does have an Oscar win, which when I tell you what for, you're going to go, oh, interesting. But only 2 nominations. And when I get into his filmography, you're going to think that's interesting too. So he's known for using like stylized, highly saturated color palettes. And he uses like experimental high-speed digital video as well. So he's big on digital filmmaking. But he uses film as well, because a lot of directors still prefer to shoot on film for a lot of obvious reasons. And he has 2 nominations for this film, which is interesting. And then he won for Memoirs of a Geisha. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's not bad. I have seen it. It's a pretty good movie. I'll get into it maybe on a later pod. And then he did Collateral with Michael Mann, which you said he should have been nominated. I wholeheartedly agree. That's a, you know, filmmaking excellence on display right there. He shot 9 for Rob Marshall as well. So got to film Daniel Day-Lewis. He did Gangster Squad, which I think you're a pretty big fan of. It's one of my underrated, really love films. And then Edge of Tomorrow, which is fantastic. 13 Hours, the Benghazi movie, which is really good too. So he's obviously, based off his films, he shoots top-notch action sequences and very realistic depictions of violence. And that's what directors come to him for.
He definitely has a lot of range and skill, because the 2 that pop off that list for me, you've got Collateral and you've got Edge of Tomorrow. You know, he works with Michael Mann, but then he has to work with Doug freaking Liman, who's like notorious for overspending, over editing, and apparently is just like a huge jerk on set. And both, to me, are really great Tom Cruise movies that give off entirely different vibes. So to be able to shoot both genres and then throughout everything you just listed, and then you throw in the musicals, he's definitely someone who's very diverse.
Well, yeah, and Memoirs of a Geisha is not at all action-oriented or violent. So the fact he won for that, if you ever do get to watch it, you'll go, oh, okay, yeah. So fantastic talent in the industry that really has flown under the radar, I would say, beyond BB.
Now into cast. We're going to kind of alternate who takes over the big part of which cast member. So you get to lead us off with Renee Zellweger as Roxy Hart.
So, yeah, Renee Zellweger, she is a two-time Oscar winner, one of only 37 actors and actresses to have won two Oscars, and only six have won more than that. So, rare company. Best actress for this past year's Judy, which is not a good film if you've seen it. Best supporting actress for Cold Mountain, which is a fantastic film, and she is excellent in it. So back-to-back best actress nominations for Chicago, and then the previous year's Bridget Jones' Diary, and then she wins the next year for best supporting for Cold Mountain. So kind of the Russell Crowe effect there with three straight nominations in three straight years. I love her in Jerry Maguire. I love her in Cold Mountain. Like I said, it's a very tough role that she deserved to win for wholeheartedly. She's in Dazed and Confused and 8 Seconds very briefly. Me, myself, and Irene, I love her, and I think she's good at doing comedy. But then, you know, after Cinderella Man, she really falls off with a lot of forgettable films, and then all of a sudden she gets nominated this past year for Judy and wins, which, like I said, it's not a good film. She is good in it, but I'm sorry, I would have given it to Scarlett Johansson.
ScarJo.
For Marriage Story, so, but that's just me. If you've seen, for listeners who have seen both films, you can make that judgment, or if you like one of the other three ladies in the category, but just an odd career. I do think she's a great actress. She is talented. The Academy clearly thinks so. It's just, I don't think she should have won two Oscars, or Catherine Zeta-Jones have won for that matter, while Amy Adams has none. Shout out to my girl, Amy Adams. And so what's your favorite Zellweger performance?
It's tough for me because I'm always so annoyed by her in movies, and I don't know why. It's just something about her. I hate listening to her. But Jerry Maguire, Cold Mountain, and Bridget Jones' Diary really are all up there for me. I think best performance due to the subject matter and the role given, it's Cold Mountain because that was rough. But my favorite, I love the original Bridget Jones with her and
Firth.
Her two male co-stars.
Colin Firth.
My boy Firth. And then, you know, it's just, I love
Grant's
that movie so much. What?
Is it Hugh Grant's the other one?
Yes.
Her other Yeah. Oh, well, she's hilarious in Bridget Jones' Diary, the original.
Yes. The combination between the three of them, it makes it it's a fun film, and that's my favorite, but her best, I think it's definitely Cold Mountain. Catherine Zeta-Jones as Velma Kelly. Like in our previous pod, you touched on Jennifer Connelly only being nominated once in her career. We get the same effect here with Catherine Zeta. She gets nominated and she wins for this film. Her only nomination in her career. She brings home the Oscar. The first time I really remember seeing her in a movie was The Mask of Zorro, which what young man doesn't remember her from that film because she was stunning. Ooh. She is stunning. You know, she followed it up with Entrapment, probably her best job as an actress in her career. High Fidelity. She's in Traffic. She showed off, you know, those great acting chops in Entrapment, and it was kind of a great job that they had Sean Connery present the award because he co-starred in the movie with her. Her most recent work has been in Queen America. It's a television series where she plays a vicious pageant coach. And she's done some stage work that got her some Tony nominations. But the interesting thing with her career is because of her battles with depression and bipolar disorder, it's kind of led to her taking a lighter load, and which is why we don't see her that often. One of the last real thing I remember seeing her in was Ocean's 12, I think. She's married to Michael Douglas, and they have two children, so she's devoted most of her life to taking care of the family. When she's on screen, she has a certain flair about her that obviously she's stunning, but she has something about her where it's entertaining when we get her on screen. I enjoyed the character Velma Kelly and what they could have done with that type of role, like the character itself, how it's written, but I don't know if I enjoyed her playing the role. I think in terms of best supporting actress, I love Kathy Bates more in About Schmidt and the few scenes she's in. It's incredible she did a lot of this movie while pregnant, but Queen Latifah might have been the best supporting actress within the movie.
I wholeheartedly agree. I much more enjoyed Queen Latifah's performance over Catherine Zeta-Jones. And I love Catherine Zeta-Jones in Entrapment, but beyond that, I'm not her biggest fan.
Yeah, I'm with you. go ahead. Tell us about John C. Reilly as Amos Hart.
So our boy John C. Reilly, this is his only Oscar nomination, Best Supporting for this. And, you know, I absolutely adore him and his talent because to me, he's a lot like the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman in that he can do drama or comedy seamlessly. And for our younger generation, a younger example to me is Jonah Hill, being able to do both drama and comedy very, very well. And just he's got a range to him. I love him in The Aviator. It's my favorite performance of his personally. I loved him in this as well. His performance individually, you name it, I feel like he nails it. So also his comedy trio of Ricky Bobby, Dewey Cox, and the Step Brothers. I love those three movies. He's hilarious in them. So what is your favorite John C. Reilly role, Luke?
The comedies you just named are just excellent. Who can ever forget him and Will Ferrell and Step Brothers and their like tandem. And this is a wild one when it comes to favorite roles, but I love him in For Love of the Game. He plays Kevin Costner's catcher, and he really embodies what a best friend and like a loyal catcher should be to his like longtime ace pitcher. It's a fun and it's a great sports movie if you can get into a sports movie that also has that romance thing going on within it. For me, it's amazing what he did in this year in film, because he did this movie, he did The Hours, and I believe he had one more. Oh, Gangs of New York, he's also in. He's in three movies that we're gonna talk about in some aspect. So he's like you said, you hit the nail on the head. He's very diverse how he can go back and forth between comedy.
He was in three of the five Best Picture nominees for this year. Then, if he's in the Hours as well,
yeah. What a career!
Shout out to the year he had back in, this would have been 2002-2003.
Yeah, Richard Gere plays Billy Flynn in this movie. We can't talk about any Oscar nominations because he has none in his career, which for me it's kind of quite a shame. He's an accomplished pianist, music writer. In fact, he composes and performs piano solos. The ones in Pretty Woman were actually him doing so. He works so hard on his, 30 seconds, 1 minute of tap. He actually spent 3 months preparing to shoot that scene doing tap dancing lessons. It's very sad to me that he doesn't have a nomination. He's in a lot of films that I enjoy, Officer and a Gentleman, Pretty Woman, Primal Fear, Unfaithful, even, that kind of a very sad tale of Hachi, which is more about his dog. And then most likely he did work on Arbitrage. But I think many would say in this film that he did some of his best work for people who are big into the musical genre. And a lot of people thought he should have been worthy of Best Actor, because if you look at the board, everyone else in the movie gets a nomination, yet he gets left off. It's very odd to me. What's your favorite Richard Gere performance?
An Officer and a Gentleman, with Unfaithful being a close second. And I did think he was good in this movie. I really did. Richard Gere is great and clearly great at musicals. You know, he, like you said, he's trained in that area. He has the talent and he pulled it off. It's just, God, what a ridiculous role he had.
Yeah, it's unique. Apparently, he's supposed to be taken as almost like a caricature, like he's supposed to be almost like a comic over the top, like we get to see in the courtroom scenes. But a very talented man. Maybe he still has some juice left to get up on that stage one day. About Queen Latifah as Matron Mama Morton. I've always kind of liked Queen Latifah in movies. This is her only Academy Award nomination in her career. but she's got several Grammys in her career. A few, she has several nominations and has won one. She's, you know, I thought she was outstanding in this film and in a bright spot, like you've added in the notes. And there's a lot of films I can go back to, and I'm like, I thought she was good in that. Like Secret Life of Bees, I thought she was pretty good in that. You know, the last Stranger Than Fiction, you've got 22 Jump Street, she's hilarious in. There's movies that she takes a part in, and most recently, Girls Trip, my wife loves. She's a talented woman.
I don't think she's in 22 Jump Street. Did you mean the movie with Jimmy Fallon where they're...
No. I think it's called 22 Jump Street. It's
with Jonah Hill and
yeah, she plays a role within it. She's not like a main character, but she's uncredited. She doesn't have like I wouldn't say you would be like, you'd have to actually be watching, but they threw her in there and she's got like, you know, like a minute screen time.
I will rewatch because I legit didn't know she was in that. I love both of those movies. So. Yeah. Dominic West. So brief role for him, starring as Roxy Hart's lover, killed lover. Anywho, so for me and maybe our listeners, I know him as The Wire's McNulty. Great show. But for you, Luke, you know him from?
The Affair. I think both
on Showtime.
Both are Showtime, right? Yeah.
No, The Wire was a HBO, okay. HBO show.
Yeah.
I think big time HBO show around Sopranos era.
So when
you need to watch it, when
I watched this movie, I got the free month of Showtime for a trial. And then I heard so much about The Affair, I started watching, and I'm only midway through like the first season or so, but he's good. Even his character in like 300, where he's a dirtbag, you know, you enjoy him on screen.
You would love him in The Wire as well. Fantastic detective.
I keep hearing I will give it a watch. IMDb versus Rotten Tomato scores. This is where Zach and I talk about, are we over, are we under some of these scores that come out? So for IMDb, it gets a 7.1. with only 209,000 reviews, bringing it in as one of the lowest reviewed films that we've covered so far. On Rotten Tomatoes, it gets an 86 on the tomato meter with an 83 audience score. However, it is the 42nd ranked musical on Rotten Tomatoes of all time. Where are you at?
Obviously, I'm going to go under the 7.1. I mean, I'll give it a 6 just because of the production value and all that jazz. Oh, see what I did there. And obviously, I'm going to be way under the tomato meter and the audience score as well, 86-83. So it's got to be at least, I guess, a 60 for me.
Woof. You're almost into where they changed the logo from the tomato to the splattered tomato. I'm under on the 7.1. I'm more of like a 6.4. And then for the tomato meter, if you think back in our pods, I believe Gladiator was in the 70s. So if Gladiator's in the 70s, based on a point of references there, this is in the 60s, like a 65-ish range. I can't believe it outdid Gladiator by 10 points for its tomato meter.
Yeah, it's insanity.
Normally, our next segment we would do Sell It to My Dad. I want you, because first of all, this is a musical. So once Dad hears that in any sales pitch, he is going to immediately say, no, I'm not watching that, because he's very old school. So sell my dad on watching a musical.
Okay. So, Marty, a good reason to watch a musical, not this one, don't ever watch this one, would be, generally, in a musical, you're going to get some pretty good choreographed dancing, some good actual musical bits in the film as well, like the music you listen to. It'll sound pretty good, and the singing's not bad. Second thing, a lot of times the plot's pretty wild. You get a really risque, cool plot to follow within the musical. And thirdly, normally there are some gorgeous people in musicals. You get some very good looking women and, you know, some good looking leading men as well. So, you know, it's fun to look at for the most part, if you choose a good one. So if you want a good one, come to us. We'll have some good ones to recommend, just not this one.
I think you hooked him on the good looking women part.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, into the breakdown. This is where we go in depth in the plot. For all our listeners, all as always, spoiler alert. So the film opens with a big band playing some music in a club. Backstage, we get the stage manager. He's frantically looking for someone. And then a woman comes in out of a cab. She enters in backstage. The stage manager's yelling at the woman, implies that, well, you know, where's her sister at? She tells her it's just going to be her in her dressing room. She hides the gun that she has on her person and then washes the blood from her hands. It's an interesting montage, right?
I thought it was great. Like, that was the best part of the movie, because I thought, man, if it's going to be like this, this is good, you know, because that was the most normally shot part of the movie. It flowed. It was in sequence, and we didn't get into all these alternate fantasy burlesque things, but you know, I'm sorry to go on a rant.
Well, you are right, because then this goes into the we are informed that we're the Onyx Club and that we're going to listen to the famous Kelly sisters, but it's only Velma Kelly, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. She does her solo musical act. It's meant to be as a duet, and it's actually taking place in a club, so it definitely makes sense. It's kind of like that Moulin Rouge vibe. But then Renee Zellweger looks on from the crowd, and she envisions herself being part of it. Her boyfriend, played by Dominic West, tells her he's taking care of trying to get her up on that stage. And as this musical number continues, we get these, this is when we start getting like the back and forth between two different, which it's not back and forth between like singing, but we get this flash sideways of Zellweger and her man. They're heading home, both clearly drunk. They end up in bed together. And as they begin to make love, the police arrive at the club and the musical number ends. At that point, I mean, the only hint we had about Roxy Hart being married was her bedside picture. That's when we first go, oh, that's not her husband.
Yeah, she flips it down.
Yes, which kind of segues into this next scene. We see that a month has passed as Roxy and Fred have a conversation in her apartment. She explains that Velma Kelly was arrested for murdering her sister. She discusses wanting to start a club with her boyfriend. He explains he doesn't know anyone from the club and that she's just a two-bit hack and that he's basically just in their relationship for the fling. And he aggressively shoves her, and in her anger, she pulls a gun from a drawer and then she shoots him to death. We get a flash to cops looking around the apartment and Roxy's husband, played by John C. Reilly, signing a confession. An assistant DA walks in, he puts them both in their bedroom and begins to interrogate them. The plan is clearly that he's going to lie for her and say it was self-defense. And as Roxy starts to daydream, and you talked about how this movie kind of shifts weirdly, it shifts into her singing a number that's dedicated to her husband. But while he's simultaneously being questioned by the assistant DA, but Amos starts to make some connection that she was sleeping. Been around on him, and he basically just sells her out right there, and the DA is all over it, and he arrests her for the murder of Fred, and she's taken to the car by the cops, and this is when we first get our big part of the media trying to cover murders in Chicago. I immediately started hating her at this exact moment. She's trying to sell Amos out.
Yeah, that was pretty awful of her. And yeah, it's same. I was like, man, she is not a good person. Because at first I thought, oh, here's this girl, she's got a dream, wanting to be on the stage. Nope. Not quite.
Not at all. And it's not like, I mean, she got shoved, but I don't think the guy was gonna kill her. And she just like, you know what, I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
So a montage begins to show, it shows her getting booked and placed in jail and on being sure other women. But then she starts to have this other conversation with a cellmate, but enter Mama Morton, played by Queen Latifah, and we get this flash sideways, which this one, it was okay with me because it's an enjoy. It was like a get you up all out of your seat. It's kind of, you know, draws your eyes to the screen. And she gives this big performance that implies that she's kind of the head CEO there. And Mama stops hard at the door and explains that she's going to help take care of her. You know, and she takes her to Murderer's Row, where she actually gets to meet Velma Kelly, who's not too inviting. Roxy gets placed in her cell. Mama walks away. And as Roxy sits in her cold, dark cell, the reality starts to set in. She begins to cry. But as she cries, we start to get all these other sounds from the prison that begin to segue into a musical number where all the other women from Murderer's Row, they start to either give a name or a word associated to their murders and kind of like tell a little bit about their stories. This is where they play the musical He Had It Coming. What were your thoughts on that song and that sequence?
I hated it. I thought it was awful. I liked Queen Latifah, Mama Morton's first song, you know, like when she first arrives to jail. I was like, wow, this is a musical bit of this thing that I can actually enjoy for once. But man, the He Had It Coming was brutal.
I mean, for some of the women, I don't understand why they committed murder. Like, yeah. I didn't understand. The one girl, I mean, there's one within the group that ends up, you know, spoiler, ends up getting hung or hanged later. She's like, I'm innocent. I didn't do it. But the rest of them, it's like no remorse. And I don't understand the one. It's like the guy popped his gum too often.
Yeah, we're going to get into that later, too, in the criticism as far as the point of all of that. Because, yeah, it just ties into why are all these women murdering so much?
Very odd, especially around that time. So the next day, she's working in the laundry, and she delivers fresh towels to a bathroom. While she's in there, she overhears Mama having a conversation with Velma Kelly. It's revealed that Mama kind of acts as like a manager for the inmates and tries to kind of piggyback on some of their media fame. You know, Roxy tries to have a conversation with Velma and get some advice, but it doesn't go well. Mama walks out, though, and she tells Roxy she wants to help. And she explains to her that she needs to hire Billy Flynn as a defense. And she asks for $100 to make the phone call. As this is going on, we get introduced to Richard Gere. Not my favorite sequence with the We Want Billy musical number. And he starts to perform. And his performance, the song is All I Care About Is Love. But it's definitely clear, based upon him getting fitted for the suit, the car he's in, all those things, that he's definitely about money and fame. He walks in the prison because he's going to be the defense for Velma Kelly, and she asks for help, and he says, do you have 5K? She offers sex, which he rebukes, and he once again tells her it's $5,000, which I did some math. Based on inflation, that would be around 60 grand today.
Pretty penny for a lawyer back then.
Yeah, absolutely. We get to see our poor guy, John C. Reilly, visiting him in his office, and all he can give him is $2,000. He doesn't have the full 5K, and they have this heated exchange. But Flynn, due to his devotion to his wife from Amos, he says, yeah, I'll do it, and you can profit off of all of Roxy's belongings and then give me that money.
Yeah, says because the media sensationalized her that they'll buy her stuff.
Which is bonkers when we get to that point and they're buying like her underwear and just anything she ever owned. I don't immediately go, oh, that guy's a murderer. I want to go buy his underwear.
Yeah, it's going to tie into my
okay, questions. All right. I won't step on issues. So Flynn, he visits Roxy in jail and they start working on their backstory that they're going to sell to the media. And he's shocking her with all, hey, you know, he's so quick with these like stories that he's like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You know, they create this huge arc. But at the same time, he's also working on Velma for her performance because the whole thing with him is everything is an act. Roxy does a new little haircut, and it's evident that now Flynn is more excited about her than he is about Velma. Velma visits Roxy and tells her, watch out, Flynn's going to try to hog the spotlight. Which segues into a press conference she has with Flynn, where every question she's asked, Flynn steps in to answer the question. So that gives us the musical number of him playing a ventriloquist for her. And Roxy's played her role in the musical is to be kind of a dummy that he's playing. In reality, he's answering the question. So we get the back and forth, and the media starts to sympathize with her. Because of the story they're telling, that basically she acted in self-defense. And we get this news montage that shows her celebrity has grown in her cell. She's got flowers, postcards, letters, all this stuff. Tell me about the ventriloquist scene.
Oh, I loved it, as in it was the worst of the movie. You know, I have no doubt, as an actor, that took some talent to pull off for Gear and Her, but as far as its place within the film and what it does for the story and plot and just musicals in general, I just thought it was god awful. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a musical number from a musical that bad.
I like the choreography and like how it, you know, everyone in it is doing their dance. The backup dancers are doing their role well. It's weirdly shot because Gear's above them and he looks larger than life, yet they're below. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting scene. I love Gear in it. But yeah, as far as how it goes in with this, I understand the theme is to say that he's pulling all the strings, but it's a very odd way to get, you know, from A to B. I'm with you on that. The next day, Velma walks into Mama's office, and she is just frustrated that she's now taken a backseat to Hart. In fact, Mama tells Velma that her paper run's dried up. There won't be a tour that she had discussed once she gets out of jail, or if she gets out of jail. Velma, though, she tries to make a pitch to Roxy, and this is one of my least favorite kind of musical scenes in it, is when she's trying to recruit Roxy, and after Act One, Roxy does the... that was rough for me. And then after the second one, Roxy just tells her off and rubs it in her face that she's now washed up. Not my favorite sequence.
I'm with you. It's brutal to watch.
Roxy lies in her cell listening to the radio as Billy dines downtown with her friends. And while he's doing that, he overhears about a murder that took place, a triple homicide of an heiress murdering, played by Lucy Liu, like a very small role for her. They show what occurred. Lucy Liu murders three different people, her husband, two lovers. It's an actual true crime of passion. And Roxy begins to see that her moment in spotlight is vanishing. So she fakes fainting and lies there. And then she tells them that she's pregnant, which immediately, now everyone's back on her side. She visits a doctor, and the doctor tells Billy that, yeah, she really is pregnant. Billy sees straight through it and realizes that the doctor and Roxy just had sex in the doctor's office. Once again, not a big Roxy fan. Amos shows up to, you know, as she's being questioned by the media, and he's like, I'm the dad. And they don't even acknowledge him, which does go into one of my favorite scenes when Amos goes to Flynn's office, and we get this back and forth because Flynn doesn't even remember his name. And Flynn basically doesn't even want him there. And he tries to tell Amos that he's not even the father. And it, you know, he kind of gets him riled up to divorce her, which is all part of this grand plan. But it's interesting on the Mr. Cellophane number where he tries to put on the clown makeup, John C. Reilly added that in because he always has wanted to play a clown.
Oh, okay. Which
is wild to me.
And as someone who loves Dewey Cox, he is a fairly good singer, and I didn't like the song, like, because the song's sad, but he did well in performing it.
Yeah,
it is. Shout out to him.
One of the saddest parts of the movie. So, Roxy walks in to an office to meet with Flynn, and they have this heated exchange where she tries to fire him, but he just quits. A fellow inmate becomes one of the first females in the state of Illinois to be put on the, you know, the hangman's noose and is killed. But the film does this weird bounce back between her doing some type of acrobatic act on stage, but in reality, she's in front of a crowd and she dies, but the crowd in the other reality is like clapping like a standing ovation. And Roxy looks on in sadness as she sees that her fellow cellmate is now dead. After the hanging, she does exactly what Billy wants, because she begs for him to be back, and he tries to calm her fears by explaining that court is just a big production. The scene transformed into this song and dance that intertwines with the trial. Would have loved to have actually seen what he's saying in the trial, but it is, I like the point that he's trying to drive home, is that court sometimes can be a production, and it's about those 12 people on the stand. Can you convince them with your storytelling? I once heard a quote from, I'll get into that when we talk about favorite scenes later, that's tied. It's a quote from a lawyer about this whole setup. This whole big production goes on, and the ruse, the whole thing that's going on with them, it works with the jury, including putting Amos on the stand and him basically making him look like the bad guy. It's a wild sequence.
Yeah, razzle dazzle them. Another musical number I did not like, and I'm with you as someone who likes courtroom dramas. I would have loved to have heard how he made her case and, you know,
yeah, got her free. Let's see him razzle dazzle them.
Yeah, it's rough.
We get Roxy finally to take the stand to try to basically justify her affair. She gives the version that she's been coached up on. It's one gigantic production. It ends with her fainting again. Velma and Mama are shown in Mama's office listening to the trial. Velma just loses her mind about just taking a back seat and how Roxy stole her idea of being on stage. Mama shows Velma, though, that she's got Roxy's diary. And in fact, Velma Kelly gets called in to be a rebuttal witness to Roxy's testimony at the trial. And the assistant DA, he admits Roxy's diary into evidence, and Kelly reads a passage from it, and it condemns Roxy 100%. But on the cross-examination, Flynn, he does this tap dance number, but he also coerces Kelly into reading a different passage, and then he basically implies she's either lying or that the prosecution is corrupt. And, you know, we get this flash to all of Chicago listening in on the verdict, and the jury finds her not guilty. But there's gunshots heard outside, and Roxy Starr quickly vanishes into oblivion because a new woman will take center stage over the murder of her husband. How are all these women getting these, like, these revolving pistols to shoot these men?
Well, what's confusing about the story. Like, where's the violence? What's this violent surge coming from where all these women are killing their husbands or random men? Like, I don't know.
I know Chicago in present time is one of the, you know, the most crime-ridden cities in the United States, but geez. So it's revealed that Flynn had planted the entire diary sequence and orchestrated all of it, and it also helped Velma Kelly get off on her case. Amos waits for Roxy after the trial, but once again, she shoots it down that there's no baby, and she's more focused on losing her center, you know, in the spotlight. Amos leaves, rightfully so, because he realizes there's no hope for him. We get to see Roxy auditioning at a club. Velma Kelly visits after her audition that didn't go well, and Velma pitches the idea of them working together, and it's obvious that she, too, is struggling with a lack of income. We flash to the Chicago theater. Both are performing, using their fame off their previous murder trials to boost their careers. In fact, their act does have them firing fake Tommy gun machine guns at a screen. The audience loves them, and they're serenaded with roses and camera flashes as the camera cuts the end credits. There's our running down. So, and this is going to be tough. I know definitely for you when we get this. Favorite scenes. We're both on the When You're Good to Mama. So we both have that as one of our favorite scenes. What's your second?
The Queen Latifah, When You're Good to Mama, definitely. And no, I tried to find three for this sequence. I was going to honor, you know, our setup. And so the opening montage, like I said, I enjoyed that from, through when Velma performs, I guess, up to the point, maybe Dominic. I know not that far, but through to the point Velma performs was normal and good to me and well shot. Yeah. What about you?
No, I'll agree. I really like the Mr. Cellophane. It's sad, but I just love Riley in it because, man, that guy, the only character I really, and I'll get into it later, but the only character I really feel connected to and want a good ending for is his character. And he is Cellophane. Mm-hmm. Everyone sees right through him in this movie. And I'm just glad they gave him, you know, it's weird. The two of our favorite scenes, you know, Latifah only has one big number, and he only has one big number. So we're slowly getting into where we just like, you know, little bits and pieces. What's your third one?
I liked the Roxy Hart song and dance bit after she talked to, I believe it was Mama Morton, you know, where she's in her sparkly dress and all that. It wasn't terrible to me, so I put it down.
Oh, yeah, like after she's hit her kind of fame and she's in her cell with all her stuff.
Yes, yes.
I like the razzle-dazzle concept of a courtroom because, and now I'm going to get into it. One of my dad's best friends growing up was an attorney, and he used to tell me, because back then that's what I wanted to do with my life, he used to say, Lucas, a good attorney understands courtroom procedure and how to enter evidence and understands the law, but a great attorney knows how to win the jury. And that's kind of like Billy Flynn's whole thing is, I mean, he does an objection in the movie. It's just supposed to be a funny scene, but nothing's even been said yet. His whole thing is about creating this story and making a big production. I wish it was like a little bit of the razzle dazzle them and then them actually showing him do that in court. I know that he didn't have enough time, but that's where I'm at. Favorite quotes. Do you have any?
I put none down. I was good with the ones you selected.
Okay. So I really like, it's probably the best quote in the movie, when they're, this is where we get yes. to figure out like the arrogance of Billy Flynn, but apparently also how talented he is. And Richard Gere says, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but if Jesus Christ lived in Chicago today and he had come to me and had $5,000, let's just say things would have turned out differently. Wow. What a guy.
Yeah, one of the few lines I was like, that was pretty funny.
Yeah, that was good. I just love that, you know, he says objection and sustained, and the assistant DA is like, Your Honor, I haven't even asked a question yet.
That was a funny part there, razzle dazzle.
Yeah, and then my only my favorite quote as regards to out of a song, we talked about Mama Morton, but you know, she goes, don't you know that this hand washes that one too? When you're good to mama, mama's good to you. That's the whole song. It does provide stuff to who she is like her, what her character's motivations are. Okay, this is a musical. Talk to us about the score. Who's our composer?
The great Danny Elfman is our composer on this. And that's, you know, something I can respect for his career. Not the work he did as far as coming up with the orchestra and that part of the music good. He obviously didn't do any things with the actual lyrics and whatnot. That's, you know, part of the original Chicago musical. But so Danny Elfman has not won an Oscar in his career though, but he has been nominated 4 times for Good Will Hunting, Men in Black, Big Fish, which I have not seen, and Milk, one of your favorites. And I love him because his music is really unique and it's associated with the Tim Burton, Michael Keaton Batman films and some of Tim Burton's other films he's done. And he's just as much the powerhouse like Howard Shore and others who have won an Oscar. He's done the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies. He has a collaboration with David O. Russell as well on Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle.
I want someone out there to watch Nightmare Before Christmas and not hum one of those songs for at least a day. I dare you. Danny Elfman is a gift. You just listed, I think, 10 movies I'd rather watch than this one. And yes, oh, Big Fish, man, you got to go watch that. What a, like, it's
Jim
almost
Carrey,
like,
right?
It's almost like the Odyssey.
Is it Jim Carrey?
No, it's Ewan McGregor.
That's right. Okay. I kind of remember that one. It's like a Ben Butt, well, not like Ben Butt, but an age type story.
It's more of, it's like, so the whole concept is the father who is played by, I always get him confused with Brian Cox. It's not Brian Cox though. The father, he's known in his life for being quite the storyteller. So the movie starts with him laying on his deathbed and our boy Billy Crudup going to visit him. And then it circles back to over his entire lifetime. And it is done by Tim Burton, but over the entire life, Albert Finney is the dad. Over his entire lifetime, he would tell stories of his life, and the son, you know, he struggles.
Doesn't believe them.
Yeah, he never believes them, but when he finally has the funeral, all these people come out, and Ewan McGregor plays the younger Albert Finney, and it shows. It's like a Forrest Gump mixed with The Odyssey, because you get like there's a giant in it. There's all these things that couldn't actually happen. Danny DeVito plays your ringmaster. You get like all this. It's a wild movie, and the score, he should have been nominated. I'm shocked that Men in Black. That's kind of wild that that
got right. That's what I thought. But hey, I appreciate that endorsement of Big Fish. I will add that to the list, and I'm sure our listeners who have seen it can agree with you that it is a good film.
So normally we'd go into what did the music add to the film. This is a musical, so I don't think we have to go too far on that. Any thoughts?
Man, beyond what Elfman did, not much. I hated the songs except for Mama Morton's, and Cellophane was good. It was just sad.
So that can be contributed to John Kander and Fred Ebb, who apparently are the songwriters from the original musical. So we'll get into casting cut. This is where we discuss possibilities, who we would have had cast instead, all the ins and outs amongst the cast. So one of my first ones in the research, Charlize Theron initially secured the role of Roxy Hart, but when they went with a different director, she was taken out. Alicia Silverstone also auditioned. How's this look like? How's this movie look with Charlize?
Give me Charlize Theron in any movie. She is fantastic. Shout out to her and her recent nomination on Bombshell, which you told me to watch, and I loved her in. Oh, God, I love Charlize Theron. We could do a pod on her movies easily.
Oh, yeah, the last decade.
Would it have made the movie better? I don't know about that one. I don't even think she could save this film.
I think personally, I would have liked it more because of the things I already talked about Zellweger. Yeah,
yeah. Obviously, yeah. I prefer her too.
Rob Marshall wanted Keanu Reeves for the role of Amos Hart. But even more bonkers is that Charlie Sheen did a reading for the part.
I can't believe he got to that point, but I guess he was still doing 2.5 Men at that point, so somewhat keeping it together.
I can't imagine either one of them in that role. You needed,
oh God, no.
Like, John C. Reilly embodies, like, that broken husband for some reason. Yeah. I don't know why.
Well, and he can do music, too, so it's just more natural.
The next one is really, and I'm going to do a hard sell for one of them that should have been, or I'm buying, I guess. So it's Angelina Jolie, Cameron Diaz, J-Lo, Julia Roberts, and Gwyneth Paltrow, all considered for Velma Kelly. They ended on Catherine Zeta-Jones. Give me the J-Lo version of this.
I'm with you.
Like, just because from a performance standpoint,
well, yeah,
she's going to rock it.
We're both big fans of her, too. I think we both can agree she's a legitimate actress. So anything involving music, you know, why not put her in as someone who loves Selena? I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. She's a gift.
She is.
We go into, for Matron Mama, played by Queen Latifah, the first choice was Kathy Bates. But she had a scheduling conflict with About Schmidt that was released the same year. I love me some Kathy Bates in a lot of her movies.
She's a gift. I love her too. To this day, she got nominated this last Oscar back in February. She's fantastic. Just such an underrated talent, even though she has, you know, she won for Misery, which, have you seen that? Oh,
yes. Man,
such a good movie. Yeah, yes. Yeah. She has a range. You can definitely say that about Kathy Bates.
She plays a great psychopath in that movie. John Travolta offered for Billy Flynn, turns it down. It was the fourth film in Richard Gere's career that John Travolta was offered before him and had turned down. I don't have the list in front of me. I just had it, some of the research.
Did he take all four?
Yes. Which is unbelievable. I don't know if that's ever been done. What does this movie look? I mean, Travolta, well, I've seen him in, you know, obviously Grease.
Hugh Jackman was also offered the role, and he turned it down. He you know, great in Les Mis,
and Greatest Showman.
I'm just gonna keep saying, Luke, I don't think any great person like Travolta, who is great in Grease and Hairspray sucked, but you know, either way, he's fit for musicals. Even he couldn't save this. And you know, Gere is good in this role. Like I said, Gere does a good job. It's just, man, the plot and everything else.
I'm with you.
Which leads us into.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead with issues.
So our issues with the movie, I mentioned before the ventriloquist scene to me is probably the worst scene of the movie. I think the acting and the music are so over the top. It just borderlines on being ridiculous. I honestly thought everyone did better than Catherine Zeta-Jones, and yet she's the only one that wins an acting, you know, award for this, which is really confusing to me. I mean, I thought she did good with the music, but I don't know, just not that impressive to me. And like we really broke down, how the musical sequences, they just distract too much from the story. Jumping around from what the scene is to a burlesque scene, in a separate location and playing them side by side. It's just not how I'm used to musicals and how I think they should be done. And what really confuses me about the plot, what is the theme or moral of this fucking story? I'm sorry, but like, is this about sexual liberation of women and redefining gender roles in the 1920s with all the murder? I mean, what am I supposed to take away from this? I legitimately don't understand, like, what do you get out of this at the end of it? Like,
Showtime,
as a strong reader, what's the theme?
Showtime gives, their tagline when you try to look up a movie, and it talks about it being a movie about crimes of passion becoming the nude, thing to get people off in a courtroom. And I'm like, that's a very small, and in reality, there's only when we go back to they had it coming, there's only a few of them that had actual crime of passion. Like Lucy's Lou's little scene, that's a true crime of passion. You walk in, your husband was two different women. Our main protagonist literally just killed an unarmed man. So how's that? I'm with you. What's that? How's that the theme?
All these women that are in jail, yeah, for violent crimes, and giving the time period, I just don't get what they're trying to say. It doesn't add up. And yeah, that's such a narrow, I guess, yeah, you're going to relate to the people who have went through this, but that's going to be narrow and they're not going to get to watch the film because in theory they're in jail. So whatever. Chicago.
I'm with you. Not a fan of the unusual storytelling. My biggest issue, I guess, would be that I have no sympathy for anyone other than Mr. Hart. Like, he's the only one that really gets shafted. He's the only one that's like, it's not like he's trying to be bad. Hell, he almost goes to jail for her in the opening scene. And one of my other ones, and I'm a nitpicker, like, where's the prison warden? Like, I know that who am I to question prison protocol in this era? But it's like, it's the Wild West in there. They're just like, they're getting radios in there and all this stuff. There's like no rules. It just seemed impractical. And the hanging scene's tough. I don't want to know why they switched back to her being on stage and everyone clapping. That was a moment. And I understand this is more of a comedy than a drama, but that was a dramatic scene. Nothing's going to be funny about someone being put to death, especially since she's the character that was apparently innocent out of all of them. Like, that's the worst part of this for me. And give me more Queen Latifah.
I'm with you.
Now we're going into Greatest Resume Edition, where we throw out some names and then we circle back to see if we had to turn in a resume with only one film on it, would this person put this film on it? We'll do kind of rotisserie, or we'll kind of throw some back and forth. We'll start Renee Zellweger. What is your Greatest Resume Edition?
I talked about what I personally like of her, but if I'm her, she has to put Judy down because that gave her second Oscar, and it is in the Best Actress category. So I just think it's natural she puts that down. This gave me my second, Oscar, and right. I'm in elite company.
Right. She has two Oscars sitting in her house, is what I have on my notes. It's hard to put this as her Greatest Resume Edition. Maybe if the resume was being turned in so you could star in a stage play, then maybe you would list this. But I don't think anyone connects her to this movie when we talk about performances. So her Greatest Resume Edition for me, I go Cold Mountain, but with that whole recency principle, it's a slash Judy because that's the most recent one.
Well, I mean, in Cold Mountain works too because she won for that. So they're interchangeable.
Who do you want to throw out next on our list?
Oh boy, let's go ahead and do Catherine Zeta-Jones.
I got a good take on this. So do feminists around the world crush me if I say that marrying Michael Douglas is her greatest resume addition?
Wow, man.
I'm kidding. That, you know, like last week, it's only her award in her career, so it's definitely this. You know, a lot of people in their lifetime get to stand on that stage and make a speech. Neither you or I will probably ever have that possibility in our lifetime. So for her to have that, she has to list this is her greatest resume addition.
Yeah, unless we get to write in some movies. Well, you know, I'm with you too. It's this because it gave her golden female instead of man. And I will say though, Entrapment, I think is her best performance though.
Yep. Let's hold off on director. Let's get into the lead man. Let's go all the way down. Richard Gere.
Oh man. You know, I've made the case on previous pods. If you are a part of film that wins best picture, you should automatically put that down on your resume. Obviously, if you don't have a best actor or supporting, but I'm not going to do that for Richard Gere out of spite for this film. And honestly, do you think Richard Gere today looks back on this film and is happy he was a part of it or that it won? I don't know. I mean, maybe he is. But so for me, I will do an officer and a gentleman.
So I put no, and I like, don't get me wrong, he's good in this film. He won a Golden Globe for it. But for me, give me Pretty Woman or give me, because for Pretty Woman, that movie holds up pretty well as far as if I put it on today in front of someone, they most likely would be entertained enough to watch because it's a fun watch. It's a good Julia Roberts role. And, you know, as far as rewatchability go, not a lot of people have seen Officer Gentleman, and it's a great movie, but give me Pretty Woman for him to throw it out there.
Well, and being in a leading role in both of them too. That's what I like about it.
Rob Marshall, our director.
Oh man, well, it's Chicago, sadly for him. And I won winning Best Picture, but also it being his first film after coming from the musical, theater world. So shout out to you, Rob, for pulling that off. I just hate your movie and it didn't deserve it.
I also have this, but I put It Depends ultimately. If he's turning in an application to direct a film, then obviously he puts this. But he's won a few different primetime Emmys, and he's been nominated for several Tonys. So if he's wanting to get a job in that, field or that genre, then he's clearly would list something from one of those productions. But as a film director, it's this. John C. Reilly. I'll go ahead and lead us off. So, he gets a nomination, and it is a Best Picture. He has such a small role in this film, but when he's on the screen, he does well. And I guess in regards to combos that I mentioned with being a nominee and being in a Best Picture, you could definitely argue this. But for me, and this is going to be wild, bulk of his career is going to be in comedy. So I would list Step Brothers.
Wow.
I think first, it just depends on what he's trying to go after. If he was trying to go after a more dramatic role, I still think he puts Aviator or like Perfect Storm or even, The Hours, apparently he has a some type of role in. But for his total career, I'm putting Step Brothers. Like those quotes still, you could say a quote right now and someone most likely will know it's from.
I respect that. I love him so much more in when he does choose to do drama. So I'm going to go with The Aviator as just being my personal favorite of his. And it was one, it's a Scorsese movie, two, big time Oscar nominations. It was a Best Picture nominee. So for him, it would not be a step down. And in the fact that he played a pretty good supporting role.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's talented, man. Hope to see a lot more of him going forward. We'll get into our last one that we have on the list. Queen Latifah. Where's this at for her?
For film, it's got to be this. For music, no. And for film, this, she was nominated, and she's one of the few bright spots of it. So she's got to put this down if it's a film-based resume.
Yeah, I put she's a Grammy-winning performer. So obviously, for whatever she's trying to get in, you know, as far as getting a deal or whatever, she clearly would go in that. As far as movie goes, she got a nomination. And like we talked about, not a lot of people get those. So she would put this down on that CV and turn that bad boy in. Any other greatest resume additions?
None. Let's get into the competition. What I've been waiting for. Woo! Good movies, folks.
Let's roll through some of these competitors from our list. Do you want to take the honors? You want me to go with one of mine first?
Why don't you lead us off?
All right, I'm going to lead off with The Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. This is the second installment in Peter Jackson's epic saga. This movie is regarded by most critics, and I would think most fans, that it's the best of the three. It has one of the greatest battle sequences probably ever shot on film, and has this very, like, Empire Strikes Back doom and gloom for a lot of the heroes until you get to the end. It's a long movie, just like all of them, but there never comes a time in it where I think you lose interest or become less invested. Like I said, the battle at Helm's Deep for me is everything you ever wanted out of a movie with this concept. And then the tremendous cast also helps drive this movie home for people out there during quarantine and during this COVID-19 crisis. If you're wanting to binge something, I know the rage right now is to binge series. Watch these sagas and just give them a chance. They may seem nerdy to you, but I can guarantee you there's a lot of manliness and a lot of great things and heroism going on in these that anyone can watch. And they're family friendly. Give Lord of the Rings, Two Towers a shot.
Absolutely. And I'm with you. The best of that trilogy. So I'm going to talk about The Hours, a Stephen Daldry film. Great cast. It's got Meryl Streep, Julianna Moore, Nicole Kidman, Ed Harris, Tony Colletti, Claire Danes, Jeff Daniels, John C. Reilly. So all-star cast. And it's you know, so The Hours, it's based on a book. Nicole Kidman plays Virginia Woolf, for you literature fans out there, a tremendous American literature writer, female American literature writer. And so basically this story is told in three different time periods, and Nicole Kidman plays Virginia Woolf in 1923 with the other characters filling out two other time periods in 1951 and 2001. So multiple timelines. It's an interesting story overall. I can see in a field of 10 why it being nominated. But when we talk about the snubs, it wouldn't have been my pick, but just the all-star cast, and it's very well directed as well. You know, they put a lot of work into it. So it's a quality film. It's just, it wouldn't have been my pick for five.
It's one of those movies. It's like, it's not the most exciting watch, right?
No, it's fairly dull, but it is cool how they blend the three time periods and the multiple characters. So they do pull that off well.
Next up for competition, Gangs of New York. So for me, if Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, Daniel Day-Lewis, Liam Neeson, like, do I say more? Like, look at
John
this
C. Reilly.
Like John C. Reilly, you have the older Gleason, you have Cameron Diaz. Like, look at this movie. Like, it can seem a little too long for some people, but you get a great performance from basically everyone. The recreate, like the visuals in it are fantastic. Like the recreation of Manhattan Island, like how they did that. That's, I can't even fathom putting together a production that large. You have this classic, like revenge seeking child to a murdered father, like a very Godfather too. You want to try to rise to overcome that person. You get what I would believe in my lifetime, two of the greatest actors, and possibly two of the greatest actors ever, at least in the top 10, with one of the best directors. It's hard for me to look at this movie and go, yeah, what? It should have, it was nominated for 10 and it struck out. He's, you know, easily a great watch if you're into some like fighting scenes, or if you're into some of the type of political things I just kind of brought up about overcoming an issue, then Gangs of New York is something you should definitely turn your eyes to.
Well, and as Scorsese fans, just an epic masterpiece. Like, it's Mona Lisa on canvas. It's, you know, it's just something to behold. And yeah, I'm with you. What a shock that it did not win anything. Our last of the five is The Pianist. So The Pianist is a Roman Polanski film. I personally adore this film. To me, it is the greatest Holocaust film ever made, and I did watch Schindler's List for the first time recently, so I can make that statement and compare the two. I just prefer The Pianist. Adrian Brody gives one of the few shattering performances of his career and never returns after this, but it's just heartbreaking look into a Jewish Polish family in Warsaw, and you know, basically this classically trained pianist and Adrian Brody losing his entire family to the Holocaust and being the lone survivor and staying with him and what he goes through. It's heartbreaking, and it's really like one of those hauntingly beautiful things to watch, if you know what I mean when I say hauntingly beautiful, given the content. But it really, he took something as delicate and sensitive as the Holocaust, and he made it for me seem real. And well, not that that's stupid to say. He made it for me truly feel what the emotions may have been like to have even been close to that situation.
Yeah, his performance, and it's such a strange career because I want to say one of the greatest parts about his performance are the things he does when there's no dialogue. Like,
yes,
how just you can see the despair he's going through and the struggle. It's definitely it's not a movie you want to rewatch multiple times if you're someone who, like, it's hard to stomach the atrocities that took place during that time era. But his performance is definitely up there, and he's the youngest Oscar winning actor ever.
To this day.
What about snubs? Movies we thought got snubbed.
Just a heads up, folks. We got a few. I'm going to lead off with Road to Perdition. Sam Mendes' second film was Road to Perdition. Tom Hanks, Paul Newman. The last film Paul Newman acted in, I'm pretty sure. And the last film that famous cinematographer Conrad Hall that we talked about on the American Beauty Pod, the last film he was able to shoot. And it's a very good film set in like the Prohibition era, where Tom Hanks works for, you know, Paul Newman as this hitman basically for the mob, and gets double crossed. It turns into a tale of, you know, revenge and violence, because Tom Hanks has a young son that survives the atrocities that happen, and, you know, just going through violence at a young age and retribution. It's just such a beautiful film. It's immaculately filmed. And just a quick production note I want to share from that: Conrad Hall was filming Newman, and Mendes came up to him because he was crying, and he's like, "What's wrong?" And he's like, "He's just so beautiful to film on screen." Like, he's just so taken aback that he was getting to film Paul Newman. Incredible. For those of you who know Paul Newman, legend.
I'm next up with a snub, and I just got Zach to watch it, but about Schmidt. So for our listeners out there, Zach and I are big Jack fans, And like several actors from his era, you know, I can think of like Pacino. It's very similar in this. He found a version of himself that he could kind of play over and over, but in a way that ultimately worked. You know, not for everyone. That's not for everyone. They want to see something different. But he wins an Oscar 3 years before this in a movie you and I both adore, where he plays a huge jerk. This movie follows a guy who's essentially a very similar character in that he's got a lot of like hurt. He's got a lot of anger. You know, he just retired from his job, but you still get to see that there is a heart there. And he literally takes a journey in this RV, but he takes, you know, like this figurative journey of letting go of some of that pain, confessing his own wrongdoing. And then he finds himself in like the twilight of his career. It has several hilarious moments. In awkward situations for him, but like ultimately it may leave you with a nice cry. Like legitimately the last 10 minutes, like it brought tears to my eyes, because of his connection with that, adopted boy in Africa that he gets all these letters back from the nun about. It's just, it's a fun watch. If you're someone who likes Jack's hijinks, like go watch it.
I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad. Another one that you brilliantly suggested. It's a great Jack performance. My next one is About a Boy from the directors of American Pie, which I honestly didn't know until I did some research on this.
I just found out today from you just now.
Yeah, very, very good directors, very talented guys, the Weitz brothers. So About a Boy is a fantastic story with Hugh Grant, who I adore. I love Hugh Grant's acting. And basically, he's a rich, spoiled, rich kid living off a trust fund because his dad wrote one famous Christmas song in like the 1950s. So he's a middle-aged man living off it. And he meets Nicholas Holt, for those of you who know Nicholas Holt, as a little boy who is just very awkward, a nerd at school and getting bullied. And he really just, because Hugh Grant has no direction in his life, he basically breaks down he breaks down each day into units of time and activities to do so he can get through the day. He meets this boy and takes him under his wing and gives him confidence, and like it brings Hugh Grant around into being a good person. And it's just a really beautiful story, and it's so well filmed. And he ends up helping Toni Collette, who is Nicholas Holt's mother, who's just horribly depressed, and a great coming of age story and a great kind of coming of age story for Hugh Grant as well, his middle-aged character. So if you haven't seen it, watch it. It's a feel-good film.
First time I ever watched it was in your apartment with Dustin McCutcheon. I don't know why he had it on, but we watched it together, and yeah, that was my takeaway. I was like, golly, this is a good movie. Like, give me more Hugh Grant. And Nicholas Holt's actually gone on and done several different projects, so he's not one of those like child actors that flamed out. Next Absolutely. Up for me, I've got Catch Me If You Can is something that I thought kind of got snubbed here. It's fast-paced fun, and it's good for all audiences. Like, this movie gives you Leonardo DiCaprio playing a master forger that's based on a true person that did it at a very young age, from like 17 to around 21. He, you know, became an airline pilot. You know, all he really did was hop on rides and act like he was part of the, you know, of the airline, that he was a pilot, but he had forged all the documents. He faked being a doctor. He passes the bar exam and fakes being a lawyer. Like, his ability to do that as a real life person, but Leo's adaptation of it is incredible. And then you get Tom Hanks that plays the detective that chases him and eventually arrests him. Like, I'm going to keep going, but should I even have to, when I say Leo and Tom Hanks are in a movie together where they have dialogue and they have scenes? It's a rarity to see.
Who directed that again?
I don't know, Zach.
Steven Spielberg.
Yes, for our audience out there, it is a Spielberg film, which, like, you know, he's a top five. He's an icon. He's an icon. And then if you're someone who kind of like enjoys a little Christopher Walken, he plays Leo's dad. He actually got nominated for Best Supporting here. Some of his scenes later on in the movie, when Leo starts to when Leo's character really starts to get into all this forgery, they're classic scenes. And, you know, like I said, it's entertaining. It's clean. It's a great mix of drama, comedy, and the pacing keeps you invested. You've got two great actors, a great director, and it's a fun watch.
Absolutely. Okay, so my next one is Y Tu Mama También, which is Alfonso Cuarón's first film. For those of you who know his work, Gravity, the recent Roma, a fantastic, fantastic director, truly an amazing Mexican director. His cinematographer on this was the great Emmanuel Lubezki, who is referred to as Chivo within the industry, who has, I think, won three Oscars for best cinematography. I think the most ever for any cinematographer. Just fantastic work on Birdman and some other films. And so Y Tu Mama También, it was kind of, so for me watching this as a 13-year-old, you know, it's kind of my dream. It's a movie essentially about Diego Luna, for those of you who know him, and one of his, the other actors and actresses in it aren't very notable. They're all from Mexico. Or at least, you know, they're not any other works that we know. But anywho, Diego Luna is the main one, and him and his best friend meet this middle-aged woman who has found out she has cancer, and her fiance is having an affair, and they tell her how they're going to go to the beach, and she takes a trip with them, and she ends up sleeping with both of them. So it's like a movie about sex, you know, and drugs, and this woman basically coming to terms with the fact that she has terminal cancer, which that's what she finds out as well. Not only that does she have cancer, but it's terminal. And so she's heartbroken, and she's just kind of going through this liberation phase with these two younger boys. And these like 17, 18-year-old boys find out on the trip that they've both been cheating, like, with each other's girlfriends. So, you know, they betrayed each other as friends, and she ends up abandoning them at the end of the trip, and it just breaks apart their friendship. And there's just this great scene at the end where they come together years later to talk about it. And they all actually end up hooking up towards the end of the film as well. So it's, you know, a very erotic, sensual film, but it's not all just about that. And I really loved it as far as Alfonso Cuarón's first film.
It is. That was this great throw in by you, because I didn't even think of that for this year until you threw it in on the notes, and I was like, oh dang, that's a good pick.
Very good movie.
Our next one for a snub is Adaptation. It's very rare that a film gets a nomination for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, which it won for that, a Best Supporting Actress nominee, a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination, but not get a Best Picture nomination. It's a very rare occurrence. This movie stars Nicolas Cage. He gets nominated. Chris Cooper wins for Best Supporting Actor. You get Brian Cox. You have a little bit of Ron Livingston. You get Tilda Swinton. And oh, wait, Meryl freaking Streep is also in it. It pairs, once again, Spike Jonze with Charlie Kaufman. Spike Jonze is a two-time Academy Award nominee. He won for Best Original Screen or for Her. And then Charlie Kaufman, I believe, is a three-time nominee, even for an animated film. And he, you know, they're known for their very wild and strange scripts. The entire screenplay, it's bonkers. So Nick Cage is playing Charlie Kaufman, who is the writer in the movie, who's been tasked with attempting to write a screenplay adaptation of Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. Cage also plays a fictional twin brother, because Charlie Kaufman does not have a twin brother. So he plays this fictional twin brother named Donald, who's absolutely nothing like Charlie. Charlie is shy and socially awkward. And the opening monologue is about basically how much kind of depressed he is. He even gets as far to almost committing suicide in this movie. The premise, yeah, like I said, it's bonkers, but it's incredible. Like, Chris Cooper is the Joe Exotic of orchids in this movie. Like, he doesn't have two front teeth. He's got like long hair, but he's like obsessed with horticulture, and he has an affair with Meryl Streep, who's a married woman, but she's the writer of this book that like did all of her research on this guy. And they get caught up, and they're trying to use the orchids for some like drug ring thing, and Donald and Charlie when they go to, like, because he struggles to write a screenplay, when he goes to, like, watch them and stuff, they end up trying to murder him. And they end up, you know, like, his twin brother does get murdered. And then Streep gets arrested, and Chris Cooper gets ate by a crocodile or alligator. It's like, it's unreal. It's wild. It's original, though. Like, Cage, he might bring one of his best performances of all time because he has to play two different characters that have so much screen time. It's wild. It's original. You know, it's a lot of fun. If you're someone who isn't afraid to watch outside-of-the-box movies, which a lot of what Kaufman does do, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, it's, you know, it's out there. Her, you know, it's out there. Anomalisa, the animated film, which is a great film, like, and for a lot of people that go through depression, you can really resonate and, like, connect with that film, even though it's this unique animation. You know, the Writers Guild of America voted this the 77th greatest screenplay of all time. You're like, oh, what's good about 77? We got to think how many movies are in existence. Uh-huh. Yeah, like, that's quite a...
Yeah, that's a top 100 film. So yeah. That's a big deal. That's a big deal to them.
I'm just shocked on the snub part because of you get all those other people nominated. I think it just goes down to when something's wild and that out of the normal playbook, it sometimes gets lost in the shuffle. So speaking of nominations.
Maybe because also he got nominated for being John Malkovich. My last snub is Unfaithful.
Good
Unfaithful.
One.
Adrian Lynn film starring our man Richard Gere and Diane Lane, in which she got nominated for Best Actress. Fantastic performance by her. My second favorite Richard Gere performance to An Officer and a Gentleman. It's a movie about the title. Essentially, Richard Gere is married to Diane Lane. They've been married for 20 years. They have like a 10-year-old son. Diane Lane has an affair with a French man she meets by chance in New York City. Chance encounter, gets hurt, you know. Falls in love with him. Richard Gere ends up finding out, confronts him in a fit of rage, kills the man, you know, has to hide his body. Eventually the cops come around and they make the connection because there was just enough evidence of her being in his place, just various things they've found. And it has one of the better endings of a film that I can remember. It ends on a very chilling note. Basically, you know, Richard Gere kind of thinks that, or he realizes that it's only a matter of time before they find out what happened. And the film ends with them parked in front of stopped at a red light. A police station is in the foreground and they're discussing running away as the red light, as the light just keeps changing. They're not moving. Yeah, just an incredible way to end a film. For those of you who have seen it,
it's thrilling.
You can agree. Yeah, I hate the subject matter, you know, but it's
a but I root damn for good story. It's sad, but I
oh
root
yeah. Oh no, yeah, no. I'm just yeah, definitely.
So this is the part of our podcast where we get into who our five would have been, which, of course, that's going to change when we get further through in time when they widen the field. So when we're looking at our five, I see yours typed in. I've got mine.
Well, I left my fifth.
But. Yeah, I was going to say, your four that you have, I also have. So now I'm waiting on your five. So for me, I do have the Two Towers, just like you. I have Gangs of New York, just like you. We have The Pianist. We have Road to Perdition. And then my fifth was Adaptation. What is your fifth?
I figured with you recently seeing it, not saying the recency bias, but I take your word for it that, you know, Cage gave an unbelievable performance as a top film. So I respect that. My fifth is Unfaithful. When I really think about that film and the others that we've talked about, to me, it was perfectly made. It's so like immaculately filmed, and you know, the light, everything from the lighting to the color palettes they use. It's so beautiful. And then just what it does to you emotionally to watch and go on that journey. It's very powerful.
I agree. It's very like in the bedroom esque in tone.
Right. Yeah. I didn't.
Which we covered on our last podcast for our listeners out there. I had one more thing on the adaptation piece. You talked about being John Malkovich. The movie actually opens with Nick Cage is on set of being John Malkovich, and it shows like an outtake, and John Malkovich is a huge jerk in the outtake, but then he leaves the set and he just is having one of his many meltdowns of the movie outside the set where he has, you hear his inner thoughts.
And what a meta scene to show
him, yes.
You know, Charlie Kaufman there. Wow. That's a great flourish right there.
Finally, we get into our who deserved the award. Do you want to take it, or would you like for me to lead off?
You know what? I'll go first.
All right.
So I believe The Pianist deserved Best Picture for this year and for this Academy Award, and I'll tell you why. My main reasoning, if Schindler's List could be honored, you know, as the best Holocaust film of all time or as a best picture winner and whatnot, the Polanski, that's a whole separate category. I'm not a Polanski supporter at all. I do think he's a brilliant filmmaker. Obviously he made a brilliant, beautiful movie, but he won Best Director for this, didn't win Best Picture. That rarely happens. And I just view this as a little bit better than Schindler's List, and I just can't justify Schindler's List winning and this not winning. But maybe the Academy's thinking was, well, we already gave one Holocaust film, you know, Best Picture. Why would we do it to another? So that's my pick. What is yours, sir?
So for me, this was a close battle between a few films, and I'll list the reasons why I picked the one I end up picking. You know, I can't go with another Wild Script like adaptation because I just picked Memento. So I struck
right.
And I had just watched it and I didn't want to use, like, kind of like you talked about, I didn't want that to be, you know, because it was the last one I've seen. Three straight years, Peter Jackson's adaptation of The Lord of the Rings gets nominated for Best Film. He wins the year following this for probably the second best film in the trilogy. Two Towers is hands down one of the best of the three, and it has a perfect blend of everything you want in a saga. The heartbreak, the joy, the struggle, the victory. It's an incredible film, and I love it so much. If it's on TV and I'm at my in-laws, I play it. It doesn't matter at what point it's being played. But that being said, give me all of the Leonardo DiCaprio, the Daniel Day-Lewis, and the Martin Scorsese that I want. I love original storytelling, and in today's film industry, everything that dominates our screen is like a reboot, an adaptation, a comic book. And you know, it's not necessarily that's always a bad thing, but film used to be about creating this like new idea, and it's extremely difficult to do. Like, you look at something like Game of Thrones that had no source material in the last year and it struggled, or like Star Wars, the recent trilogy, it was rough. In Gangs of New York, I know it had some inspiration because it is based on historical events, but very loosely based. And, you know, I already talked about Daniel Day-Lewis, Leo, and Liam acting in it. It has one of the best directors. It has a three-headed monster of writers that, like, all have contributed to, like, great movies and have great resumes. And it's hard for me to look at it and not choose it. I think Brody's performance is one of the best from that year in The Pianist. But you have that combination, like Daniel Day-Lewis gets nominated for Best Actor, and he's not even really the main actor in the movie. I mean, technically Leo is. Like, if they had put DDL in for Best Supporting Actor, he probably wins it. Go ahead.
Daniel, I'm supporting what you're saying here. Daniel Day-Lewis was robbed for Best Actor. From nothing against Adrian Brody, but this is arguably, with the exception of There Will Be Blood, this is his best performance ever. Like,
yeah.
he is so chilling, so scary as Bill the Butcher Cutting. Like, you cannot take your eyes off him, and he stayed in character throughout filming. He got freaking walking pneumonia because he refused to wear a certain type of coat because he said it wasn't from that time period.
He's like the total ultimate method actor. Like,
and I'm, and it's just his performance in Leo's great. And to me, this is like one of Scorsese's masterpieces as far as telling such a, you know, a historical epic, you know, across this time period. It's just, it's so beautiful. And obviously it was my number two pick, and sorry to cut you off. I'm with you. This is such a good movie.
It's like the lack of recognition the Academy gave to this movie is why they get so hounded on about their like animosity towards Scorsese. Like, I know he finally gets his, you know, he gets his golden man for The Departed, but like, this is an all-timer with an all-time cast. And like you said, Bill the Butcher is like him, his character in this and There Will Be Blood are very similar in ways, but both are like, you just can't take your eyes off of everything they're saying. And for me, this is my award goes to.
Well, lucky for us, we get to dive into The Departed a few pods from now, and we'll have a proper dive into Scorsese for all our Scorsese fans, because this film was rightfully snubbed. And yeah, I'm with you.
So any other final thoughts in regards to Chicago?
I have none. I'm glad to have watched it for the pod, but beyond that, I'm not glad to have watched it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast. Next time, we'll be breaking down the 76th Academy Award winner for Best Picture, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. One ring to rule them all. I'm Luke Shoemaker. He's Zach King. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Washes that one too, when you're good to mama.